And now a look at local and statewide news. Kodiak's athletic community lost an icon this past weekend with the passing of Joe Coach Floyd. Floyd and his wife Carolyn moved to Kodiak in the 1950s. He was a teacher, coach, and athletic director. For many years, he was Kodiak High School's only coach in virtually every sport, as well as many non-sporting events. In fact, Coach Floyd was responsible for starting most of Kodiak's wide range of athletics and sports programs at the high school. And it wasn't just for the jocks or the best players. Floyd was there to encourage non-players and those who excelled in non-sport activities. Larry Ledoux is the superintendent of the Kodiak Island Borough Schools. Since he grew up in Kodiak, he remembers Floyd from his earliest days as both a teacher and a mentor.
When I became one of his students, he would sort of take care of me because I was a tall non-basketball player. And when I became a teacher, he used to advise me and help me. And when I became a principal, he again advised and mentored me. And no matter what job I've had, whether it's a teacher, assistant principal, principal, superintendent, commissioner, every time I met Joe, he was always there to give me solid advice and to tell me he supported me and was proud of me. And the same thing happened the last time I talked with him. It was, I'm proud of you, you know, don't forget activities, you know, and so I will miss him. He's been a big part of my life and my career growing up in Kodiak.
As he has for just about anybody who's gone to school, or at least several years ago, and then from then back, he was instrumental in starting virtually everything in terms of sports at the schools, correct?
Oh, there's no doubt about it, and he was an advocate for proper facilities. I know North Star, when they were building North Star, they were building a smaller gym, and Joe showed up at the borough meeting and said, you need a bigger gym so we can do activities there, and the next thing, we had a bigger gym. That's all it took was for Joe to stand up and say, this is what we need for kids, and it would happen, and it wouldn't matter whether it was the borough assembly or the school board or the city council. They all listened to Joe, and most people on any of those bodies remember him as probably one of their teachers.
Coach Floyd's son, Max Floyd, spoke with KMXT in December. He said one of the special things about his father was his love and encouragement for all kids, not just athletes. And that helped to keep kids interested in school activities and away from drugs or other problematic activities.
And see, the one thing about Dad, it wasn't just for the chosen few. It wasn't just for the athlete that makes the star athletic team. Dad always had programs for everybody called intramurals. Intra means within, murals, the walls of the school. So the 1 hour before school would start and the first hour after school, Dad would have intramural sports, badminton, table tennis, flag football, soccer, softball, all these kind of things. Why? For the everyday student, because he knew that if he kept them active, kept them believing and looking forward to something, then they're going to stay away and they're going to think about when those vices come calling that can destroy and really pull people away from a productive, successful life. He knew that.
Max Floyd was in Kodiak in December during the 53rd annual Joe Floyd Basketball Tournament, which is named in honor of Coach Floyd. Alaska nonprofits and programs have long benefited from oil and gas company BP's donations. Now they'll have to adapt to a new kind of giving program under Hillcorp, the smaller private company poised to buy BP's entire Alaska business. Hillcorp's philanthropic strategy is more about individual employee giving than corporate sponsorship, and a national expert says that'll diffuse the giving and make it harder to predict. Tegan Hanlon with Alaska's Energy Desk has this story.
Kenrick Mock is the head of the College of Engineering at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and he says he found out about the proposed BP sale the same way a lot of people did.
We just heard it from the news like everybody else, and then it was, oh no, what's next?
Mock says BP has been a major presence in the university's engineering programs. The company funds youth summer camps and university clubs. Its employees sit on the college's advisory board.
They're definitely one of the top dogs in terms of being a player for supporting UAA.
So, Mock says BP's plans to sell its entire Alaska business to Hillcorp and exit the state will leave a huge hole at the already cash-strapped university. UAA is among nonprofits and programs across the state that are preparing for an Alaska without BP in it. Over its 60 years in the state, the oil and gas company has grown into a major philanthropic force, donating $4 million to Alaska organizations in 2018. It hosts teacher awards, funds scholarships, and pays for the bright-colored bags for a statewide cleanup program. Hilcorp also says it will donate millions of dollars, but its approach to giving is different. Nonprofit executives say it will require some of the state's philanthropies to rethink their strategies and diversify their donors. Hilcorp Alaska Senior Vice President David Wilkins explained the company's giving program at an event in Anchorage last month.
So we give away a lot of money through our employees, and that will remain to be the cornerstone of our program. Keep in mind, we're going to be taking on, you know, we're going to triple in size employees, and that means we're going to be giving a lot of money in the community.
Under Hilcorp's philanthropy program, the company gives each of its new employees $2,500 to donate to a nonprofit of their choice. It also matches employees' donations up to $2,000 each year. Hilcorp expects its Alaska workers to donate about $5 million over the next 12 months under that program. But right now, where exactly the money goes is anyone's guess.
Chances are many Alaskan charities will benefit. However, the distribution of the money is in the hands of Hilcorp employees.
That's Elizabeth Miller with the Alaska Community Foundation. The foundation will manage Hilcorp's giving program for its employees in the state. Hilcorp declined an interview request for this story, but in a statement says it aims to build a greater community of giving by empowering its employees. Since 2012, Hilcorp says, its employees have donated more than $2.8 million to almost 400 Alaska-based organizations, including food banks, youth shelters, and churches. Nationally, Hilcorp reports the largest chunk of its employees' donations, about 42%, went to religious causes. Eileen Heisman is the president of the National Philanthropic Trust, a Pennsylvania-based nonprofit that advises donors. She says the transition from corporate giving to a more individualized approach will be a, quote, bucket of cold water for some of the nonprofits that have leaned on BP.
So you're going to go from a bird's eye view, very organized corporate look at everything in the community and where the most important needs are, to many individuals deciding what they're personally interested in. And I think it's going to diffuse the giving in a way that's going to be really hard to predict at this point. But after a year or two, the charities that have been depending on BP are probably not going to be able to depend on the individual donors.
She says one big question is how many dollars will stay in Alaska. The money can go to any qualifying nonprofit in the country. Hilcorp says it will encourage employees to donate to charities in the state. Lori Wolf, who leads the Foraker Group in Anchorage, an organization that works with and advises other nonprofits, says Hilcorp's giving program isn't necessarily better or worse than BP's. It's just different, and nonprofits will have to adapt.
The real impact, right, is that you don't just write a proposal to a ConocoPhillips and a BP and an Exxon and go like, okay, I'm good. I've done my, you know, corporate grant-making process, right? Now you go like, oh, the landscape is way bigger, and I have to really be thinking about being in relationship with these a whole myriad of groups now.
And that, Wolf says, will take more time and more strategy. It's writing 20 proposals instead of, say, 3. As for UAA, Mockwitha Engineering College says they are already making changes to fill the BP-sized funding hole. That includes searching for new sponsors and raising summer camp fees. In Anchorage, I'm Tegan Hanlon.
Arctic ocean temperatures are rising at a rate faster than previously thought by the scientific community. That's the finding of a new study from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which shows that warming waters have an effect on everything from sea ice growth to marine ecosystems. One researcher says now is a key time for studies on Arctic ocean conditions before the hotter temperatures become the new normal. For Alaska's Energy Desk, Wesley Early reports.
For UAF oceanography professor Seth Danielson, the record low sea ice and record high ocean temperatures of the last couple years came as a shock.
It was a bit surprising because we felt like it came a couple decades too early.
Danielson is part of a team of researchers that authored a paper discussing the changes to Pacific Arctic ecosystems from warmer ocean temperatures. It lists several observations of the area, including weaker winter sea ice and an earlier melting period. More open water conditions mean that there's likely to be an increase in vessel traffic through the region, which Danielson says could have an impact on subsistence. Low sea ice could also change migratory patterns.
The time of the year that some hunting activities can take place may need to change. I think we've seen some indications of that already. and the species that people are hunting and fishing for may change as well.
Danielson says one of the findings of the paper is that new groundfish species like Pacific cod are showing up further north and have the potential to disrupt the native Arctic cod populations and send ripples up the food chain.
They're a focal point through which energy flows to a lot of different components. For instance, they're eaten by the seals, they're eaten directly by people, the seals are eaten by people and by polar bears.
Danielson says that researchers expected that as temperatures in the region got warmer, these effects could happen. He says research models show that the heat waves caused by global warming have become more prevalent in the wake of industrial advancement.
You can be fairly confident in attributing these types of unusual events to human-induced causes.
Danielson says that the rapid changes to Arctic marine ecosystems are happening in real time as researchers are studying them. He says these changes likely aren't going anywhere.
It's not going to be too long before these extremely low ice years that we've just had in the last couple of years will be what we consider to be the norm.
Historically, Danielson says there wasn't a lot of scientific observation of Arctic waters 4 to 5 decades ago. He says the rapid warm changes to the environment mean now more than ever is the right time to keep tabs on Arctic waters.
We're at this interesting spot now where we know things are changing incredibly rapidly, and now is the best chance for us to go out there and make some additional observations.
Danielson's research was part of a coalition of scientists with the Arctic Integrated Ecosystem Research Program. The paper was published this month in the Nature Climate Change Scientific Journal. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Wesley Early in Kotzebue.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski visited Ketchikan on Friday, where she met with local officials, tribal leaders, and business groups to discuss federal issues affecting the region. Afterwards, she sat down with KRBD to talk about her worries about growing unchecked presidential power in Washington. Murkowski made national headlines after she broke with Republican colleagues on a mid-February vote to limit the president's power to strike Iran. But without a veto-proof two-thirds majority, the resolution will likely be blocked by the president. KRBD's Eric Stone began by asking Murkowski about why she voted against her Republican colleagues.
I think what we need to recognize is the lanes of authority, the constitutional lanes of authority. And the Constitution makes pretty clear it is the Congress that has that authority and power. And so when we as a Congress either fail to exercise our authorities, fail to set that parameters, what happens is almost by default, the executive will engage in actions that maybe some would consider border on acts of war. And so how we weigh in with our constitutional authorities is significant. Our reality is we have not provided for a resolution in the Congress since 2001. We're operating under that same resolution.
So yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that 2001 AUMF, that the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, a law that allows the president to strike terrorist organizations around the world. It passed overwhelmingly with just one vote opposed in the days after 9/11, and successive presidents have used that 19-year-old law to justify operations from the Philippines to Africa. The question I have for you then is it time to replace that 2001 AUMF with something more specific? And would that be geographic restrictions, limits on resources that can be deployed without specific authorization, or other types of restrictions?
And those are fair questions to ask. But it begs the question, are we doing that? Is Congress doing that? What we're doing, what you have seen, is a response to an incident, taking out Soleimani. All of a sudden, all eyes of the Congress are turned towards what's going on over there? Who made that decision? Did they consult with Congress? Is the authorization appropriate? And we engage in that limited debate on the floor. But we don't take it back to, is the original AUMF still operational? When you think about the way that we were engaged in that war effort, say back in 01 or 02, to where we are in the year 2020, we weren't talking about drones in 2001. We weren't talking about cyber warfare in 2001. So because the way that we are approaching war has changed, don't you think it merits a debate and a discussion in Congress?
So intelligence officials told a House committee on February 13th that Russia is looking to tip the scales in the president's favor in the November election. There was another, I just saw another report on the way in here from the Washington Post saying that the intelligence officials had briefed the Sanders campaign that Russia was acting on their behalf as well. Do you see foreign election interference as a significant threat to American democracy?
Oh, I believe foreign interference, any interference in our elections is a threat. And we need to take it seriously. We need to address it head on, straight on. We cannot try to minimize it or say it's not happening to us. I think we saw full well some of that in the elections in 2016. And it was real then. We have taken several steps. We passed two bills in the Senate election security initiatives that passed very strongly. They're still sitting in the House side. You know, whether it is attempting to influence an election to help a Republican or help a Democrat, I don't care who they're talking about. When you have foreign interference in our election, you do threaten our democracy.
So what can the Congress do, though, to require that a president counter threats, election interference threats, even though they could personally benefit from that election interference?
Well, again, this is where you have agencies that are tasked with ensuring a level of credibility to our election systems. And that's their job. It doesn't make any difference if it's a Republican president or if it's a Democrat president. It is about the integrity of our systems. And working to maintain that integrity is something that we all need to exercise oversight towards. So again, for those who would suggest that it might benefit the president to not investigate or to investigate, it shouldn't make any difference. It's all about the integrity of a system. I need to be able to believe, you need to be able to believe. Americans need to be able to believe in the honesty and the integrity of our election system.
That was U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski speaking with KRBD reporter Eric Stone.
The local news is supported in part by Ardinger's Fine Furnishings, home of the Tempur-Pedic Ergo Collection and the Tempur-Pedic Breeze, made especially for those who sleep hot. The Breeze cushions and supports you while channeling excess heat away from the mattress. Tempur-Pedic's Ergo Base allows you to move the bed into multiple ergonomic positions for sleeping or relaxing. 486-5554.
And by Arctic Physical Therapy Services, Incorporated. Professional rehabilitation for all your physical therapy needs. We repair the world's most complex machine. 813 Mill Bay Road, 486-4499.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Dutch Harbor is still number one, and so is shrimp. More after this.
Integrated Marine Systems is the leader in marine refrigeration in Alaska. Visit imspacific.com.
Dutch Harbor has retained its title as the nation's top fishing port. It was announced last Friday in the annual Fisheries of the U.S. report for 2018 by NOAA Fisheries. Cisco Werner is chief scientist.
Dutch Harbor, Alaska, keeps its longtime title for now 22 years in a row as our nation's top fishing port with 763 million pounds landed, valued at $182 million. Of that volume, 91% was Alaska walleye pollock.
Werner said the U.S. seafood industry increased in value.
U.S. commercial fishermen landed 9.4 billion pounds of fish, which translates to a value of about $5.6 billion in the pockets of our fishermen. Compared to 2017, this is an increase of $150 million, or about 2.8%.
New Bedford, Massachusetts, claimed its 19th consecutive title of most valuable fishing port at $431 million, due mostly to sea scallops. Naknek ranked as the nation's second most valuable port at $195 million. Empire Venice, Louisiana, held the second spot for fish volume. The Aleutians was third, thanks to Trident's plant at Accutan, the largest processing facility in North America. Kodiak fell to fourth place for landings due to the Gulf cod collapse. Alaska provided 58% of all U.S. wild-caught seafood, more than all the other states combined. And Alaska accounted for 97% of U.S. salmon landings. Salmon remained as America's second favorite seafood following shrimp. Third on the top 10 list was tuna, then tilapia, and Alaska pollock. Americans ate slightly more seafood, 16.1 pounds, the highest per capita consumption since 2007. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by Ocean Beauty Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Welcome to this noon edition of the Island Messenger. It's 33 degrees with some light snow out today. A winter weather advisory is continuing through this afternoon until 6 p.m. This afternoon, expect some rain and snow for Kodiak, becoming all rain after 3 p.m. Areas of blowing snow with highs near 37 degrees. Northeast winds 35 to 40 miles per hour with gusts as high as 50 miles per hour. A 100% chance of precipitation, but little to no snow accumulation is expected. Tonight, some rain and snow with areas of blowing snow before midnight, lows around 31 degrees. Northeast winds 25 to 30 miles per hour, gusts as high as 45. Continuing 100% chance of precipitation, but less than half an inch of snow accumulation possible. On Wednesday, snow mainly before 3 p.m., highs near 36 degrees. North winds 15 to 20 miles per hour and an 80% chance of precipitation. Again, little to no snow accumulation expected. In Homer today, it's 20 degrees and overcast. This afternoon, a 30% chance of snow after 4 p.m. In Anchorage, at 16 degrees and mostly cloudy. This afternoon, a high near 20 degrees with north winds around 15 miles per hour. 20% chance of snow for Anchorage before 9 p.m. Mostly cloudy otherwise with a low around 11 degrees and north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday in Anchorage, a 20% chance of snow in the afternoon. Quick look at the marine forecast. From Marmot Island to Sikkenak, there's a storm warning today. Northeast winds of 50 knots with seas at 28 feet with rain and snow. Tonight, northeast winds of 35 knots diminishing to 25 knots after midnight. Seas at 24 feet subsiding to 16 feet after midnight with rain and snow. Chiniak Bay also has a storm warning today. Northeast winds of 50 knots diminishing to 40 knots in the afternoon. Seas at 21 feet subsiding to 16 feet in the afternoon with rain and snow. Tonight, northeast winds of 30 knots, seas at 12 feet with rain and snow. Marmot Bay has a gale warning today, northeast winds of 40 knots with seas at 18 feet with snow and rain. Tonight, northeast winds of 30 knots, seas at 11 feet with snow and rain. Shelikof Strait has a storm warning today. Today, northeast winds of 50 knots, seas at 24 feet. Tonight, northeast winds of 40 knots, seas at 16 feet, subsiding to 10 feet after midnight with snow. All right, let's look at our tides. Actually, I don't seem to have tides in front of me at the moment. Well, okay, today is the 25th of February. Sunrise this morning was at 8:15 a.m. Sunset tonight will be at 6:32 p.m. That's 10 hours and 16 minutes of daylight, which is 4 minutes 57 seconds more than we got yesterday. The record high on this day was 48 degrees in 2011. The record low was 1 degree in 1986. Okay, and now for tides. High tide will be in at 2:55 p.m., 8.63 feet. Low tide will be out at 9:13 p.m., negative 0.22 feet. Over on the west side, high tides at 3:28 p.m., 15.30 feet. Low tide will be out at 9:47 p.m., negative 0.84 feet. A few minutes for community announcements. City Council is holding a regular meeting on Thursday, February 27th. That meeting begins at 7:30 p.m. in the Borough Assembly Chambers, 710 Mill Bay Road. The meeting is open to the public. You can call the City Clerk's Office at 486-8636 for more information. City Council is holding a work session tonight. That begins at 7:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library Multipurpose Room, also open to the public, and you can also call the Clerk's Office if you have questions. The Rural Alaska Honors Institute, or RAHI, is accepting applications. RAHI helps rural and Alaska Native juniors and seniors learn about what it takes to succeed in college. Accepted students will spend 6 weeks, May 26th through July 10th, at UAF's Troth Yeddah campus, earning up to 11 college credits, exploring Alaska's interior, and gaining volunteer experience. The program, including airfare, is free to students, and applications are due on March 1st. For more information, visit uaf.edu/RAHI. The Future City Fire Station Replacement Project Steering Committee is holding a meeting today. That meeting begins at noon, so I guess get there quickly if you haven't already. The meeting is open to the public. That's at the City Conference Room, 710 Mill Bay Road. Senior Citizens of Kodiak is holding a regular monthly meeting on Friday at 1 p.m. in the Center's Multipurpose Room. That meeting is open to the public, and you can call 486-6181 for more information. And finally, the monthly meeting of the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center Board of Directors is scheduled for Tuesday, so that's today, starts at 6 p.m. and is also open to the public. All right, well, that's all I have for you for today. Let's go to Talk the Rock, where today our guests are from the Aleutic Museum. We'll be talking about photo archives.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.